One. Hi everybody, thanks for joining us. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter Llewellyn. I run the services at medcomsnetworking.com and the associated websites. So this is news, information, resources, services, activities for people who work in and around the global medcoms community, by which I'm talking people who work in and around medical communications, medical education, medical publishing, and the associated businesses. Lots of information at medcomsnetworking.com. We do a lot of webinar type activity and generate a lot of video content. You'll find that all over at Network Pharma TV. Importantly, we also do quite a lot to try and encourage people to look at medcoms as potential career options. So you might be interested in being a medical writer, account manager, or whatever. You'll find lots of information at firstmedcomsjob.com. And so on and so forth. There's lots of things to go and have a look at if you haven't already explored. Today, absolutely delighted to have Trishna with us. Trishna Bharadia, I'm not going to introduce you, you're going to introduce yourself, but basically you're here as a patient advocate and absolutely delighted. I'm a little bit of a fanboy. You've done some great work over the last few years in and around Medcom, supporting some of the agencies and pharma and so on. The last time we met was on a webinar, I think it was something like October 2020, something like that. And I remember talking because one of the things I was interested in that stage was the pandemic was hitting us. We were well into it, I suppose, by that stage. But I remember us talking about how, in a way, there's a positive side in that we were opening up opportunity for patients to get involved in activities. Obviously, things like events have in, you know, historically proven a little bit of a problem in terms of getting patients to and encourage themselves. I don't want to go too far down this line. We'll come back to it in the conversation. But I remember talking about the fact this is a great opportunity to involve patients and the patient voice, however that was done, because digital type activity, opening up virtual eventing and so on, surely meant a more inclusive a way of going about things. And I'm sort of, without putting you on the spot or telling you too much about where I'm going to go with this conversation, I'm sort of interested to know whether that's actually your experience of what's been achieved over the last couple of years. How are we doing as a business and an industry to take notice of that patient voice that everyone talks about so much? So, okay, Trishna, over to you. Tell us about yourself, a little bit of the personal journey, and we'll go from there. Members of the audience, please, the text boxes are there. Ask your questions. Share your own observations and so on. But Trishna, tell us your story.
So really pleased to be here today. So my name's Trishna Bharadia. I'm based in Buckinghamshire in the UK. And I'm a patient engagement consultant and patient advocate. So that means basically I work with lots of different stakeholders, including the pharma industry, CROs, medcoms agencies, and other types of vendors, academic institutions, scientific publishers, patient groups, clinicians, basically you name it. And I worked essentially to better embed the patient voice into the healthcare ecosystem and the medicines development lifecycle. So even though I'm based in the UK, I work both in the UK and also internationally. And some of my key areas of interest, which I'm sure we're going to delve into today at some point, include good patient engagement practices, diversity, equity, and inclusion issues in healthcare and research, and also patient involvement in health information and scientific publications. So I work within disease area and also above and across disease area. So some of the areas that I've had projects in recently, just to give you a flavor, include neurology, respiratory, oncology. I've been working in this space for coming up to 15 years now, believe it or not. And I got into it like most people through a diagnosis. So, I think you'll be hard pushed to find any patient advocate out there who didn't get into it because they'd been diagnosed with something, or they were a caregiver for somebody who'd been diagnosed with something.
Right.
So I live with several long-term health conditions, including what people know me best for is multiple sclerosis, which I was diagnosed with in 2008, age 28. And that's really where my journey started and has brought me to where I am today. So I'm also a patron and ambassador for several health and disability related organizations. I'm a visiting lecturer on patient engagement at King's College, London University. And I'm also an honorary member of the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Medicine, which is part of the Royal Colleges of Physicians. I think I'm only one of, I think, two patient advocates who are a member of the faculty. So it was very, very privileged, but also felt like, wow, this is a huge opportunity to potentially shape some of the faculty's work. I think that's me in a nutshell. I mean, if people are interested in how I got to doing what I'm doing, my journey so far in the patient engagement space, I'm sure we can talk about it more. But I think I've kind of sum things up as succinctly as possible. I think, I mean, there are people who know me on this call and who are aware of just the sheer volume of stuff that I do. So I often say, you know, people say to me, Trisha, can you just tell us what you do in a nutshell? I'm like, well, how big is the nut?
Of course, of course. But I am interested in that early stage. You know, what did lead you into the patient advocacy work that you're doing? And in particular, into working with industry. I know there's a little bit of a story there. So, but do just paint that little bit of a picture. Take us back to the beginning.
Yeah, so as I said, I was diagnosed at the age of 28 in 2008, and basically that diagnosis wasn't a good experience. Believe it or not, I was literally handed this life-changing diagnosis, and then I was just sent away. My then neurologist, who isn't my neurologist now, he literally wrote down the names of the four medications that I was eligible for and said, come back in 2 weeks, tell me which one you want to go on. And there was no signposting, no, like there wasn't even a mention of like the MS Society, where to go to for trusted information. And this was at a time when, I mean, we were talking about 2008. The internet, yes, there was stuff online, but not in the way that we have today. And so it was a really tough experience, because not only were me and my family dealing with the physical effects of me being diagnosed with MS, and at the time, my younger sister was also basically started to show symptoms of what would eventually go on to be diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. But we were also faced with essentially this black hole of we didn't know where to go to for support, services, information. And that's where I really thought, well, this isn't on. this experience isn't good. How can I try to change things? And that's what led me to starting to volunteer with some of the charities. So the MS Society, MS Trust, MS UK. And through that, I started to speak at events. I was volunteering for Asian MS, which is one of the support groups that works under the umbrella of the MS Society. And in the meantime, so we're talking, you know, so a couple of years, I'd started to attend research days. I learned that I could also change my care. So I moved my care to a specialist MS center. And then I started to essentially become an informed patient. I became much more confident about talking about MS, my experiences, not just amongst other people who have MS, but also with researchers, with clinicians, with people who are working in the field. And then my new neurologist, he's fantastic, key opinion leader, just really well known on the global stage. And he runs these preceptorships for industry. And he said, Trisha, would you come and speak at one of these preceptorships as an expert patient? And that's really where my work with industry began, because I went and I spoke at one of these preceptorships, and there was somebody there who said, Trisha, loved, you know, listening about, you know, your diagnosis, your experiences, etc. Could you come and speak at our offices? And so I thought, wow, okay. And went, spoke at their offices, and then everything basically just snowballed. One project led to another. I then started to be asked to speak at conferences. Somebody saw me speak and then would ask me to do something else. I would meet people, we would get chatting, and they'd say, oh, you know, we've got this project that we, you know, we would like some help with. And that's where my work with industry then started. And, you know, it's funny because I can still pinpoint there are certain, for example, there are certain companies that I started working with. I can pinpoint, like, which conference did I first meet someone, and like we were chatting during the coffee break and they mentioned, oh, we've got this, it might be interesting to you. So that in the beginning, my work with industry was very much centered around patient experience, patient insights, you know, that patient journey, unmet needs, all of that kind of stuff. And as I was working more with industry, whether that was with pharma companies, whether it was with medcoms agencies and vendors, I started to realize that actually there were times when they weren't getting it right. And I had a few quite challenging and what I would say poor experiences where, you know, for example, I was being handed contracts that I didn't know what I was signing. And I was too scared to ask because there was this, you mustn't talk about this with anybody because you'll be breaking confidentiality and this, that, and the other. And I was just like, I don't understand this. And it was very much, well, if you don't understand it, you need to go and get independent legal advice. I can't afford that, you know, because we can't advise you. And there was things around experiences when, you know, for example, I would ask for, you know, I after a flight, you know, I'd be asked to go to somewhere in Europe and I would say, well, can you please pre-book a taxi to take me from the airport to the hotel? Because after a flight, I'm exhausted. I don't want to be standing in a taxi rank trying to, you know, get transport. So, well, we can't do that because, you know, that's not what we do. And I'm thinking, well, if I was a healthcare professional key opinion leader, would you be asking them to do the same thing? So I was having some of these experiences. Don't get me wrong, the vast majority of experiences were great, but there were things that were repeatedly coming up. And that's where, and I think people on the webinar who know me will know that I will say when I don't feel that things are being done right or where things need to be improved. And so I started to say to these organizations where the experience hadn't been great, I said, look, I'll work with you. Let's try and improve this. Because if I'm having this experience, then other people must be as well. And you know, it does happen. I remember sitting and having a conversation. It was a patient event that was being run. It was some country. It was one of the countries in Europe. I can't remember which one. And this having this conversation with another patient advocate who was there, who said that she was really, really worried because the pharma company wouldn't pre-book her train tickets for her. They said that she had to book them and then they would reimburse her. And it was a 90-day reimbursement time. And she didn't have the money. And she was saying to me, she had to beg and borrow to get the money for this train ticket and then wait 90 days for reimbursement. And it was like experiences like that where I thought, okay, there was all this talk about being patient-centered, patient-centric, and companies felt that they were being patient-centered just because they were going out and asking patients, but they weren't thinking about how are we doing that. And that's really where my work within the patient engagement space really started. Because I then, like I said, I then started to say to organizations, let me help you. Let's work together and try and improve some of these processes. And even just down to the way in which you talk with patients so that you're not making them feel alienated, you're using the correct terminology, you're not making them feel inferior to, you know, anybody else around the table, you're making things as accessible as possible without making somebody feel like they're being a bit of a pain in the behind kind of thing. And also that you're not making them feel like we've got to make exceptions for you. But this is actually, this is a just a normal way of working, just in the same way that, you know, if you've got an employee who shows that they need to work on the communication, you know, you wouldn't then turn around and make them feel bad about it. You'll send them on a training course or something. Well, there are times when working with patients necessitates a lot of empathy, a lot of flexibility, a lot of consideration. And it was something that, you know, I wasn't necessarily seeing as much of as I think that there should have been. I just monologued for like 20 minutes.
It wasn't quite as long as that, but it was. I hope the audience is agreeing. It's fascinating hearing it and listening to you. You covered quite a lot of ground there, and it is just interesting to hear that experience articulated like that. But to draw out some different issues in there, and I sort of have sympathy with all sides a little bit. Some of what you're talking about in terms of people dealing with you on a practical level will happen with whatever company or environment Absolutely. You're in, et cetera, right? The problem the pharma industry and maybe Medcoms with it has or could have is that it starts to make out that we are patient-centric, we are particularly thinking about you and all the rest of that, which then throws some of what you're talking about into quite a severe sort of like conflict sort of thing. And I think I'm probably the sort of person who would say there's a big danger for pharma of paying lip service and tick box exercise and so on, just because we have a vice president of patient engagement, yeah. You know, and they tick that box or something, or just because we have a conference and we go, patients are able to come to this conference, you know, it doesn't matter unless it actually means something in real life. And I guess, you know, there is practical issues on all sides. I mean, I suppose I would always just say, at least maybe if we're thinking about it, that's a step in the right direction, but then communicating with each other and dealing with it and so on, and getting your sort of support to help about think about those practicalities. Because in with all the best will in the world, it's very difficult to think from everyone's points of view all the time. And if Exactly. you're organizing a conference, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of moving wheels, there's a lot of practical issues. But at the end of the day, there's no point having a meeting saying it's about patient experience or something. And we've all seen these meetings that talk about how the patients are going to work here, and you realize there's no patients involved in the conference program, there's none of them involved Absolutely. In the actual meeting itself, and actually the venue is so set up that the patients they're talking about can't get there, sort of thing. So yeah. All of that, I guess we're all just agreeing with each other, but I do think it's important that people think, some of these sorts of conversations I think are just important, because if they make people stop and think about what they're doing, then we're going to do a little bit better, sort of thing. Yeah. But let's get to
So I was going to say, it's about taking that step back. It's about, okay, this is what we want to do with patients, but then have, you know, one of the things that I often do, so for example, organizations want to run a focus group, run an advisory board, set up a patient council, run an event. One of the things that I do is I help them to do that to ensure that some of those challenges or pitfalls that people can sort of fall into, because you're right, you can't think of everything from every single angle. It's about trying to make sure that actually we've got as many bases covered as possible. One of the a really enjoyable project that I worked on was actually with I can talk about this openly, it's out in the public domain, was with Merck. It was the Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany, just to differentiate. And so for several years, they had held this, it was an annual MS patient group forum. And I had gone and I'd spoken at one of these forums and then had a debrief with the patient advocacy lead who was developing these forums. And there was various things that I said, well, look, you could improve on this, you could improve on that. The next one, I was brought onto the project team and I worked as an equal member of the team alongside the Merck lead, the Medcoms agency, the logistics agency. And from start to finish, including the delivery, so like I was helping to facilitate, present on stage, the creation of the post-meeting report, identifying advocates and patient group representatives to speak, all the logistics down to, you know, things like, so many people who have MS take medication. Some of those medications have to be taken at certain times in terms of food. And the time that we were holding this event, one of the things I said, please don't have just finger food, give people a proper meal. And all the attendees really appreciated that. And so it's some of those are the things which people just don't necessarily think about, because they're not necessarily in that, then they've not had that experience. There was a focus group that I helped to put on. And I remember, so this was held in London. It was for a clinical trials technology company. And I remember so many of the patients who took part said, and they didn't actually know that I'd been involved in the organization of this focus group. And so many of them said to the organization, this is the first time that we've taken part in something like this, where somebody's actually thought about the timing of the event. It was in central London. It wasn't during rush hour where people were trying to, you know, manage the tube when they have mobility difficulties and things like that. And they said, this has been great. Can we work with you again? That's the kind of experience that we want patients to be having, because then it builds trust, it builds the relationships, and they want to work with organizations again because they feel like they've actually been considered. And that makes a huge difference.
And yeah, no, absolutely. And it's that, again, we can apply that sort of mentality to all sorts of situations in life. You know, if everyone's got a voice at the table and we can make things work for everybody. There are some practical problems, but again, I think if we're setting ourselves up as being patient centric, let's at least make sure the patient's involved all the way through. We've got some questions coming in. I'm trying to think which way around I'm going to ask these two questions. Okay. Two questions that obviously I think are related, but follow on from what you're saying. So I'm going to just go with this way of asking. In the last couple of years, yep. Obviously, and you talked a lot of what you talked about, and let's be blunt, I mean, MS, mobility problems and so on. You've talked about events, you've talked about going to events, but yeah, so let's just follow an obvious route there. The last couple of years, virtual eventing, hybrid eventing and so on. I think I said at the beginning, you know, the last time we talked was at sort of the beginning when everything was starting to go that way. And it was like, well, this is going to open up inclusivity and so on. So blunt question, what's your experience been for the last couple of years? Have you found that you've become more involved because the technology allows you to? Let's stop at that. Let's put a question mark there. Let's start with that question.
Short answer, yes. And it's been amazing. I've been able to take on more work. I've been able to really, I would say, give more to everything that I'm doing, because essentially, I'm not constantly dealing with fatigue, burnout, having to think about, okay, if I go and attend this meeting in, okay, let's just choose Basel, because, you know, so many pharma companies in Basel. If I go and attend this meeting in Basel, then I'm now going to lose another probably 2 or 3 days in recovery when I get back. I'm doing so much work with US organizations now, which is possible because I'm not expected to fly out to the US right. Every time there's a meeting or every time there's something that needs to be done. And I think that has definitely made things more accessible. I'm seeing different voices in different people around the table. I'm part of a number of initiatives that are truly global now. You know, there's so often I, you know, see, oh, this is an international initiative, this is a global initiative. And actually it wasn't. It was North America and Europe. And actually it would be North America and Western Europe. But now, I mean, last week I was in I'm part of a patient council, and we had people from Uruguay, Chile, North America, UK, Germany, Romania. Basically it was
all over.
India, China, it was literally all over. And I was sad that I was just like, this is amazing. And that wasn't something that ever, I felt, ever truly happened pre-pandemic, because people just didn't think about doing things virtually. It was always, oh, okay, we're holding a meeting, let's fly everyone somewhere. So I think,
okay, so So pre-pandemic, the technology was becoming available. Some people were talking about it, but people weren't routinely using it. The pandemic accelerated everything. It basically just went, there's no option. So we do this. And then everyone went, oh, wow, it's actually amazing what we can do. Then let's go in a couple of two slightly different directions, okay? Or at least try and look at two, or compare and contrast, okay? So we're sitting here online. It's very easy. We're having a conversation. We've got people from all over the world listening to us. It's amazing what we can do. It's entirely suitable and so on. And lots and lots of practical reasons why this is just a marvelous opportunity. And that activity, you're saying, I think you agree, has opened up massively. Patient groups and so on, advisory groups, absolutely the marvelous opportunity. Let's just compare and contrast and bluntly with another scenario, which you've also touched on in terms of pre-pandemic, where you'd be going to a conference and talking at a conference. So we're talking about medical society conferences or industry conferences or something. So a bigger, more formalized commercial exercise, basically, when it comes down to it. The opportunity was that at those sorts of conferences, you could be brought in to be involved in programs, panels, and so on and so forth. And I'm guessing, and I think you've already implied that that has happened. My question is, bluntly, and I've slightly set you up this one, I know, I've sort of said where I'm going to go with this. Are we going backwards at all? As the conference world gets back to meeting face-to-face, my question is, are we actually going back face-to-face because that's what a certain number of people want to do, and that's how a certain amount of the business model works and so on? And is that going to lead to exclusion of people who've started to get more involved? And we've got a couple of questions on this. So are you finding that at that conference type scenario, you're being beamed in like there's no problem, video, hybrid, virtual, call it what you like? Or are you finding you're going back to a situation where people are saying, we've got the meeting in Basel, Barcelona, Paris, whatever, we need you to fly over? I'm intrigued to know what's really happening out there in real life.
It's a complete mixture. There are many organizations now that are basically just saying, if you can't be there in person, then we can't do it. I don't like the word can't, because we know that it's possible. There are other organizations which are doing fully hybrid, and that's great. There are some where it's in person, but they understand my situation or the situation of another patient advocate. And they said, okay, we'll work with you in order to make it possible for you to still speak, and we'll dial you in. So it's been a complete mixture. I found it frustrating because, I mean, there have been times where basically I felt like I'm back in that position where I'm asking for an exception, and that shouldn't be the case. I think, and I talk about this a lot when it comes to patient engagement, it should always be about options and about choice, because we need to ensure that, and we need to remember that every single patient will have individual needs and requirements and different things that will work for them. So it's about options. And it's not about necessarily having, a million different options, which makes things unmanageable or whatever. That's not the case. Sometimes it's as simple as, okay, well, we'll have internet at the conference center. All of them do. We'll set up a Zoom link and we'll project you onto a screen. And most of us who have been doing, throughout the pandemic, we've been doing lots of webinars and conferences and things like that, we're comfortable with that. I don't have an issue if I'm the only person in a panel session who's on a screen and everybody else is there in person. I'm more than comfortable with that. So sometimes I think it's more on the side of the conference organizers are more uncomfortable than actually I am. And I think we have to be careful that we don't move away from offering that choice, because it's not just about safety, because if we're talking about something like COVID, you know, there are still people out there who can't be in a room with 500 people because it's just not safe for them. But there's also about accessibility, about, like I said, things like fatigue, about how many days out of your week is it going to take, even though you're only being asked to do a 1 hour session, for instance.
Yeah.
All of those kinds of things, I think, come into play. And that's really where I think you're starting to see the difference between the conference organizers who really have patients up at their heart and are really considering patients, and the ones who are saying, well, just can't do it. And yeah.
I think this is a really interesting area. And it'll be interesting if any of the audience members want to sort of contribute their thoughts on it. We're getting a few comments coming in. And I'm not sure how one measures it. So it's just, all this is anecdotal type experience that we're sharing here. But there does seem this sort of like move back to face-to-face at the cost of everything, at least in some quarters, which just seems such a shame. Although I have some sympathies with conference organizers in this situation, I must admit. But it'd be a real shame if we go backwards from that point of view. A couple of questions came in earlier on, which I guess, and this is a slightly different question, but let's address this question now. In terms of, because some of your anecdotes, sort of like, you know, your stories over the last 10, 15 years, I guess, of working with industry, a couple of people have commented, you know, that's not good sort of thing. Has industry got better at dealing with you as a result of the work you and others are doing?
You make that sound really ominous. Like I'm great to work with, I promise.
But you said, I know, but you said to begin with, it was like, you know, there's a lot of, you got involved in this to try and help people understand how to work better with you sort of thing, okay? So I'm just sort of trying to be, but you know, the truth is, is it the case that industry, as a result of this work and so on, has improved in the way that it works with patients, whatever the individual situations around the conference and so on? I mean, would you say that the industry now is just in a better place than it was, or have we still got a long way to go? And have we still got a long way to go?
So I think, there's several answers to this, depending on what angle you're looking at. So as an industry, I think industry generally has become much more aware of those processes of the, how do we work with patients? I think that's really being reflected in things like the FPL working with patient source book, the ABPI code update, things like publication practice 2022, the update to that, where we're seeing more of, you should be working with patients. This is how to do it. You know, regulators in the US, you know, FDA is wanting to, and regulators are wanting to see, how is industry working with patients for, you know, the approvals process, all of that kind of stuff. So I think as an industry, there's much more awareness, and there's also much more support out there. So, if anybody on the call has ever attended a patient-focused medicines development, the patient engagement open forum sessions, and, you know, there's a lot of work going on around things like fair market value calculators, around, you know, there was some plain language summary guidance, there's, you know, working with patients, there's, so the WECAN has put together like contract templates. Envision Pharma and WECAN have done a patient authorship training course. There's more support out there, and there's initiatives like Paradigm, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that shows that industry has recognized that they needed to be a shift, and that shift is happening. When it comes to individual companies, then it's a whole mixed bag. You know, I'm still, you know, there are times when I just sit and I think, oh my goodness, how has this happened? Where somebody's had just a really bad experience. And sometimes it's not that it's like there's an intent behind it. Sometimes it's just the right process isn't in place, or the right training hasn't happened, or something has been missed along the way, and you know, somebody doesn't know how to do something. So I think that sort of the implementation of what is happening at an industry level in terms of the guidance, regulation, all of that kind of stuff, that is very patchwork. There are some companies that are doing things really, really well. And here I'm not talking about just pharma. I'm talking about CROs. I'm talking about MedComms agencies, any organization that's working with patients. And then there's others where it may be that they have a more conservative approach. They're more risk averse. I've been having comments. So one of the things, and people, again, who know me, will know that I do a lot of work around fair remuneration. And so there's this whole discussion around how patients should be stratified. They shouldn't all be paid just one single rate to treat them all the same. You don't do that with HCPs. There is a difference between different types of patients that should be valued accordingly, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there's one organization, and, you know, I've been having this conversation for about 5 years, and the work is happening, but it's so slow. And that's really where that things then start getting frustrating, because you have then such a wide gap between some organizations, where you then get patient advocates who are working with lots of different organizations, and they're like, well, this organization can do this and they've got the processes in place. Why can't you? You know, you're all working from, theoretically, all working from the same song sheet, because you're all governed by whether it's the FPA guidance, ABPI, whatever. But often that application or getting change done works at a completely different pace in different organizations. I was actually doing a webinar with, it was actually for the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Medicine, and there was somebody there from the PMCPA, and he was also saying that he sees that the application of the ABPI code and that interpretation of it vastly differs between companies. And also there's confusion sometimes between what the code says and what's actually internal company policy. And the code is being blamed. And so there's all these things, I think, come into play, which has meant that there is still differences between organizations. Some are doing things really well. Others, you know, have just got some catching up to do. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Let's just follow this a little bit further in terms of the regulatory type aspects. You mentioned ABPI codes, FPA codes, and so on. How much direct impact does that have on your work? How aware are you? How much impact does it have on you? You know, you're going to generally be contracted to the pharma industry to do this work, yeah? How much of a thing is the code of practice stuff? Or how that you feel as an individual? Is it restrictive or not? I'm trying not to put words in your mouth. I'm just intrigued.
So, a disclaimer here. So there are patients out there who work with industry who have no idea that the code even exists. So you're talking here to somebody who is what I would say that a very, very high level of advocate. And there are some of us out there who we make it we purposefully go out. I've done an ABPI code training course, funnily enough, I was probably, everybody else there was from industry. I was probably the most enthusiastic and excited person to be there. Because for me, it was like, well, if compliance is going to say we can't because of the code, I need to know what the code says. I need to know how to interpret it, how it's being applied. Same with the FPA guidance. So people like me, we are aware of it. We understand why it needs to be there. Is it restrictive? I think it depends on how it's being applied. I think there are times when it's restrictive, and not necessarily because it is restrictive, it's because that's how it's being interpreted. I think there is a lot of scope within the code to be able to work well with patients. Same with, you know, with the FPIA guidance, there's a lot of scope there. It just, I mean, even within the same company, you can get two people from compliance saying two different things. And so I think it's more around, I think there needs to be more guidance in terms of how do we ensure that there's more, consistency with how things are being applied. But like I said, I mean, you're talking to somebody who is at a very high level of advocacy. So, you know, I mean, I know that you ran, and I joined that webinar, and you ran a webinar about the social media guidance that had been released by the PMCPA. And again, your average patient, advocate, influencer, person who's on social media, patient who's sharing their story, won't have a clue that that's even out there. And I think this is also where it becomes really important for industry and also Medcom's agencies, because often they're the point man, so to speak, to be transparent. So if something can't be done, explain why. I remember being at an event where there was one a patient, it was a panel, and there was one patient there who didn't understand why she could not talk about drugs. It was a pharma-sponsored event. She could not talk about the medications that she was on, the issues that she was having. Nobody had explained to her why. They just said, you can't talk about medications. And that, again, that's really where you start eroding trust. Because if a pharma company comes along and says, you can't do this, you can't do that, don't talk about this, don't talk about that, you start to You start to perpetuate these myths about, well, it's big pharma, big bad pharma. They're trying to, you know, hide something or do this, do that. And we don't need that, because actually, you know, and I say this, you know, I work with pharma because I believe in what they do. There is, you know, all the people that I work with really believe in what they're doing. They want to help patients. They want to have better outcomes and experiences for patients, improve patients' lives. But we have to face reality that the pharma industry doesn't have a great reputation amongst the public, and particularly amongst many patient communities and many patients, because of whether it's, you know, in certain communities, they've not been historically treated properly, or whether it's around the pricing of drugs, around market access, there's all these things. And so there is a reality there that we still have to work with, and within that sort of context and framework. That's why transparency becomes even more important, because if people understand why, they're less likely to jump to their own conclusion.
Exactly, to all of that. I mean, it's a very highly regulated industry. You know, that just has to be accepted, but we need to be able to educate and meet, you know, the people that we're working with better. And the transparency is important.
And also transparency, particularly as, you know, there is globalization, there is internationalization, and we're getting more international collaboration. So I was on a call the other day, and this was in the meeting where there was people from all over the world. And this advocate who was from India, she had actually just spent some time out in the US. It was the first time she was going to the US. And she was absolutely gobsmacked that when she turned on the television, there was adverts for medications, and she didn't know. And then she was asking all these questions like, well, you know, why was that happening? Is there other countries? Is it just the US? Is it just India where, you know, we don't see that and stuff? And it's because actually your average patient advocate doesn't look into the regulations from different countries and things like that. So having that understanding, and, you know, the pharma industry and the people who work in it, Medcom's agencies, etc., they're in a position to be able to help inform and educate patients around these kinds of things, because otherwise, you know, they're not everyone is as curious as, you know, as someone like me, where when I do something, I want to know everything about it. And I've really worked hard to do the extra learning, to do training and things like that. You will get your, you know, working with your average, well, Joe Bloggs patient who, you know, you've contacted through a clinician because they're in their clinic, you're getting insights from them, and they don't know how the pharma industry works. And so having that, having those conversations and using that opportunity, I think will be, you know, will just benefit everybody and make for a better experience.
Okay, so I'm going to ask, we've run out of time, to be honest, so we need to wrap this up. But it's fascinating, and I could carry on talking all afternoon, to be honest. But there's a message in there, I think, which is fair to say that, you know, industry generally probably doing more than they used to. It's good direction we're going in, but it's a mixed picture. And some companies still have a lot to do. Some companies are doing it very well. There's lots of initiatives now, yada, 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 yada. For Joe, I think you said Joe Public or Joe, you know, patient, however you phrased it, but, you know, the average sort of patient advocate, maybe, you know, we need to do more to educate. It sounds like a lot of what you're talking about is driven by you, you know, you wanting to know more. So you've sort of got to a stage where you do understand the business, but is the industry just working with patients, Joe average, as it were, to use that expression, and not explaining? And therefore, is that real or is that good enough? Blunt question. As you've got to the position you've got to, and you're working with people, but you're so educated in terms of what we're doing, is there any concern that you become a unique sort of patient? So that actually, if I'm trying to understand what patients are trying to do with my product, there's a problem with you becoming so educated and so understanding that actually then I still miss what 99% of patients actually need to do. Do you understand what I'm saying with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I get asked this question a lot. And I think there's two answers to this. Firstly, so I still do an awful lot of work directly with patient communities. And that's something which I've really felt has been important to me, because in order to be able to work and, you know, be able to say what is happening within patient communities, I have to be working with them. So I still do a lot of what I call on the ground work. So I think there's that. There's also, it's about not necessarily saying, well, okay, we have Trishna, so we can't have somebody who is what we call the Joe average patient. It's about understanding that everybody brings different perspectives and different insights. So it's about having those multiple voices. So, you know, in some of the patient councils that I've set up, I've always made it clear that there should be a mixture of patient advocates and that sort of that very high level patient leaders, etc., and also people who potentially never worked with industry and are living day to day managing their condition, whichever condition it is. It's the same, you know, I get asked the question, well, if we have a patient organization representative, that means we don't have to have patients. Well, actually, again, it's about bringing different perspectives to the table, because patient organization representatives bring something different to what patients with lived experience or patient advocates can bring. So it's about understanding that and not saying, well, we just need one or the other. That's not what it's about. It's about multiple voices. And in doing that, you will better understand the patient community.
Okay. Look, we're going to have to wrap it up there, although I'd love to keep going. So I'm going to say a huge thank you to you for chatting like this and chatting so openly. I know many people in the audience, it will be absolutely fascinating. I will encourage people in the audience, I know I can speak for you, they can contact you via LinkedIn is the easy way to do it. So absolutely. Please, everyone, the whole point of these sessions is to get people talking to each other. And maybe we'll bring you back and we'll talk more about these issues, because there's so many different directions we could have gone in with this. So huge thank you to you, huge thank you to the audience. If anyone's interested in what I'm up to, medcomsnetworking.com, or reach out to me anytime, obviously. But just for the moment, I'm going to say a huge thank you again. Huge thank you. And turn the recording off. So just a quick wave, Trishna, and take care, everybody. Bye-bye.